The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Today, David, Russell Napier joins us again. I always learn so much when he's on the program.
It's interesting, Kevin. Russell works for CLSA Asia Pacific Markets, and he has an emphasis on China and the whole Asian region as an economist. He splits his time between Edinburgh and actually living in Asia. So his perspective, I think, is particularly insightful. One of the questions that we ask and sort of operate on the basis of here, Kevin, is why do we have guests in the first place? And I think a part of it is because we don't have all the answers. And we certainly have more questions than answers. And we think that there's certain experts who can bring particular insights and help us get a better perspective on what is happening in the world.
Well, and in a way, not necessarily to even have an answer, but to get a better question out of it. You know, Einstein said it's really all about asking the right questions.
And I think what we're going to do is spend some time next week, Kevin, again, kind of exploring what the structure of this weekly commentary is. There will be things with each interview that we have, which we agree with wholeheartedly, and things that we do not agree with in the least. And yet it's not our role to necessarily disagree with an interviewee at that particular point in time. What we're trying to do is elucidate certain elements and ask questions and get a very clean answer from them in terms of their perspective, seeing if that can bring value. What we'll do today, Kevin, is look at several things with Russell that I think are particularly helpful in regards to capital controls, in regards to the sovereign debt market, in regards to the equity market, and in the larger context, because again, this goes back to two interviews we've had with him in the past. Russell Napier wrote this book, The Anatomy of the Bear, in 2004, and in it he says, ultimately we will find the kinds of values we had in 1921, 32, 49, and 1982, which is equity selling at rock-bottom prices. How do we get there, and what does it look like between here and there? That's what we're going to explore today as we look at, is that a two-year process? Is that a six-month process? Is that a six-year process? Where are we at, and where are we going?
Well, and of course, Russell Napier probably has spent thousands of hours researching, you know, his book, The Anatomy of the Bear, just looking at those four bear market bottoms over the last 100 years. Let's go ahead and go to Russell right now.
Russell, in past conversations, we've discussed Tobin's Q as a valuation of a company's assets at a replacement value. Four times in a 100-year period, that value's reached a 70% discount to replacement value. And each of these periods was a remarkable time to have bought equities in retrospect. So we are currently in the context of a secular bear market, as I understand. And your book, The Anatomy of the Bear, pointed out that bear markets tend to last about 14 years. That would take us, what, to about 2014. Is there some guidance that you'd like to add, what the next couple of years look like, and then perhaps what the end game, taking us to 2014, might include as well?
I think when anybody makes a forecast, there's some things you can be more certain of than others. So the fact that we have to go back to a low valuation on the measure you mentioned, Q, but also the cyclically adjusted PE, which I mentioned in the book, I'm reasonably certain that it's just the dynamic of the marketplace that has to happen. 2014 is more of a guess based on average length, and therefore it's a dangerous forecast. However, the more important bit is to work out what the catalyst is, because if you begin to see that happening, then you think this is the sort of thing that can produce a really, really cheap equity market and significant material losses for those who hold on the way. So as this crisis has evolved, it's become more and more obvious that the crisis that would afflict equities and bring them to their lows again is going to be something of a sovereign debt crisis. The crisis we've just seen was a classic market crisis. Supply outstripped demand. Prices began to fall, began to bankrupt people, whether it was people who were borrowed against housing or people who had borrowed from various businesses. And that would be a classic overproduction, deflationary, depressionary bust. But of course, the governments wouldn't accept it, refused to let it happen, and instead have put their own credit quality on the line. And if you look at any projection from the Congressional Budget Office or any other developed world country, you'll see how this takes into severe fiscal problems very quickly. And therefore, I think it'll be a sovereign debt crisis, rising yields in government bonds, which will reduce the next crisis. And as you just said, it's not just a supply-side issue that the governments will be issuing more. A real problem will be that sometime in the next few years, we're likely to see the Chinese move to a much more flexible exchange rate, and that's going to create huge problems for the demand for U.S. treasuries as well. So 2014 is still as reasonable, I guess, as any, but I think your listeners will find it more useful to try and look out for the, what catalyst could do that. And because the governments won't let the market forces do it, I'm afraid we won't have creative destruction in the private sector. We might have to have creative destruction of the public sector.
So sovereign debts end up being front and center as a part of the end game, and you just mentioned China as a significant player in the midst of that. Are the changing policies of China, do you think, significant to the price action of either our equity markets or long-term the bond markets? And why would they change their mode of operation at this point?
They're absolutely crucial. I would say that every bubble we've had since the mid-1990s, and we've had a couple since the mid-1990s, all stem from the Chinese government's refusing to let its currency appreciate. The basic practical implication of that is they've been huge buyers of U.S. treasuries. They've held U.S. treasury yields too low. Well, in the business that we work in, just about everything in the world in some way or another is priced off that U.S. Treasury yield. That's our risk-free rate of which we begin to price everything. So if that price has been mispriced by a bunch of bureaucrats from Asia, and I should stress it's not just China, there's been many, many others, then everything is mispriced. And that's exactly what's happening. Now, why would it have to change? It has to change because the modus operandi of China and many others has been to undervalue exchange rates and export their way to prosperity. That has involved the West having to borrow more money to buy all the stuff they were exporting, and maybe some things aren't clear from 2008-2009. But our inability to constantly borrow more and buy more is one thing that is reasonably clear. So the Chinese and others will have to seek other ways to grow. I think I've mentioned before on your program that the big lesson from 2008 was simple. 40% of the world's population can't get rich selling to 14%. Which has really been what 40% has been trying to do by holding down its exchange rate. So when they begin to move forward by letting exchange rates appreciate and focus much more on domestic consumption growth, and rising exchange rate helps that, it's going to be an inherent part of the policy, then we clearly have some major problems for the U.S. Treasury market. 54% of all U.S. Treasury debt is owned by foreigners, which is an exceptionally high amount. I think by the end of the Bretton Woods Agreement, we got to about 20%. I once said that it was the highest it had ever been, and I'm told it was slightly higher after the Louisiana Purchase. But not since the Louisiana Purchase has such a huge percentage of America's debts been owned by foreigners. And when the foreigners begin to move towards more consumption-driven growth, that money cannot continue to ply into the treasury market. So that's the train crash which is coming. There's going to be less demand from that source just at a time when, obviously, supply of U.S. treasury paper is going up pretty strongly.
What kind of inflation rates would China have to see in order for them to revalue their currency? It seems that the close to $1 trillion stimulus that they had this past year would be setting that in motion. Or is there something else that would even increase inflation beyond the $1 trillion stimulus which they've put into the system here most recently?
I think that's a great question, because we can't look at China the way we'd look at the United States or any other economy, where we might think that a rate significantly above 2 would produce some sort of huge reaction. That's not the way China works. It's not the way China works because it's not a full market economy yet. It remains partially a command economy. So quite often they bring in price controls to try and bring down inflation. They simply just don't let the price of funds things go up, or they subsidize things fiscally. You live in a command economy. There's other things you can do to attack inflation. I think we probably all agree that none of these things would be inevitably or ultimately successful. But these are things which China has used in the past. So that's the first thing to point out. They wouldn't necessarily immediately go for a monetary reaction, and the revaluation of exchange rate is a monetary reaction. And secondly, the Chinese have lived with higher levels of inflation than we have lived in the West. They quite regularly see it get up towards double-digit numbers. They react to that without panicking. So when this exchange rate is allowed to appreciate materially, that's a structural change for China. It's China choosing a new way of growing. So it will be inflation which will concern them about that, but they'll be more tolerant than we think, and they'll find other ways in the short run of coping with it than we think. But in the long run, they will have to go more aggressively towards a currency appreciation. So your listeners could expect to see some currency appreciation from China coming really quite soon, but it will be controlled and is not necessarily a negative for the world. In fact, could be seen as a positive in the short run. But as it bites over a year and 2 years, as it bites in terms of bringing down the scale of China's surplus, then it also brings down the scale of China's purchases of treasury. So it's not something to panic about when it begins, and it could begin within weeks, but it is to realize that it is a ticking time bomb, and we'll have to get more aggressive as time progresses because of inflation problems. But there's lots of other things they can do in the short run. So this is not a sign that you should be running screaming from the equity market, but it is to warn you that the clock has started ticking for some inflationary consequences and for some fairly dire consequences for the U.S. Treasury market.
So the greater concern with the yuan or renminbi revaluation is a non-controlled appreciation of their currency. If revaluing exchange rates, you know, in that significant way takes the U.S. back into recession and pushes Treasury rates higher, one of the questions I would have is why U.S. governing bodies have pressed so strongly for a revaluation at all. And is that really what they're pushing for, is just that controlled, moderated 2-3, not more than 6% appreciation per year?
Yeah, I think, once again, a good question. I think there's been a bit of a schism in the American government over this. I think the monetary authorities historically have been more for the gradual appreciation, but anybody from the political side has been more aggressive in asking for a one-off appreciation. The politicians are asking for it for political reasons. We all know that many American jobs have been lost to this undervalued exchange rate. You don't have to have any political view to understand that. So for a politician, fixing that became quite a short-term target at one stage. Certainly a couple of centuries of the Treasury ago, that was an even more important issue. But I think as time has progressed, the view from the Federal Reserve has got more sway, that the best thing to be done with this is to let it happen gradually and slowly and let the world adjust to it. And I think that's the way we're going to tackle this. I'm suggesting that in 2 to 3 years from now, the Chinese might be forced into something a bit more aggressive. You might find inflation being more of a problem. But I certainly expect there to be a sort of a timetable of appreciation over the next few years, a controlled appreciation, which the world might actually quite like. As you know, a lot of people have been very fearful about a deflationary depression. And a revaluation, a gradual controlled appreciation of the renminbi in the short run, which might come along with greater hopes for more consumerism in China, pushing a little bit of global inflation. I think the markets would quite like that in the short run. But we have to realize that we're moving and marching towards this great structural breakout there in a few years from now. So I think the American policymakers are more on board now with a slow move on the RMB rather than the more aggressive pushing previously. So I think there's been some maturity there and change in view over the last few years.
Well, it seems interesting to me. We've got, again, the larger context of a bear market in which you've argued that we may see the S&P as low as 400, which would be, you know, for the Dow, the equivalent of 4,000 points, and that being sort of the end game for the equity markets and a pretty cheap place to be buying equities. And yet you see a tremendous amount of health, correct me if I'm wrong, in our commercial banking system today, significantly better than it was a few years ago, and maybe on balance relative to Europe is significantly better still. Maybe you want to explore, you know, what's happening between the central banks and the commercial banking system over the next few years in the context of this bear market endgame.
Where we sit today, we're caught between the hell of inflation and the hell of deflation. Neither of them seem particularly good for the markets, but you have to decide which one it's going to be. It's as simple as that. Where you have your wealth, where you have your asset allocation, those differ rather dramatically depending on which way you think we're going to go. Now, as we've already discussed, I'm not a long-run optimist, but I do believe that we're much more likely to break out with problems with inflation than deflation. Now, in the early stages of inflation, equities tend to do pretty well. I think we've seen that already over the last year, and I think as inflation picks up, they'll continue to do well. And historically, they've done well until inflation gets to 4%. Now, that's a number which might surprise your listeners. It's quite a high number, but we're obviously quite a long way from that. So there could be this nice period when inflation goes up. So if we're coming to that conclusion, you can't get to that sort of number. You can't get to that scenario without a return of bank credit growth. And it seems to me that we're very, very likely to have that. The U.S. banking system has been delivered an immense amount of medicine, unparalleled, I think we can say, even in terms of the Great Depression, an unparalleled dose of medicine, and seems to me to be responding to it extremely well. I think the main problem for American bankers in 2010 and 2011 will be hiding the profits. And if we look at any sort of reasonable measure of leverage or total amount of credit in the American system, it has not come down through this recession. I know that most of the front page of the newspapers proclaim the deleveraging of America, but all the evidence is exactly the reverse of that. Since the beginning of the recession, at the end of 2007, credit numbers are up across the economy, admittedly largely spurred on by the government, but they are up across the economy. Now, it's still early days. We haven't actually seen the U.S. banking system beginning to respond yet. We get weekly data from the Fed, and it's still flat to very marginally tailing off. But with the numbers that we see coming out of America, with getting close to jobs growth, looking at the service sector picking up, looking at several months of house price rises, looking at well-capitalized banks, looking at banks that are very liquid and able to make money, I think it's only a matter of time before those banks start to extend credit again and we get the credit cycle. So in the bear markets I've looked at, the first move upwards was always the shrinking of the deflationary risk, and the markets would go up, and that's what we've seen. But the second bit would be driven by the credit cycle. And of all the banking systems in the world, the U.S. banking system is more ready for that credit cycle. I should say, of all the banking systems in the developed world, the U.S. banking system is more ready for that credit cycle than any other. And if your listeners are particularly interested, they should go to the Fed's website. There's an H8 document in there which gives you weekly credit data. And if you begin to see that that credit data starts to go up for the U.S. banking system, then we're joining leg two of this equity bounce in this long structural bear market. And there's plenty more upside in equity. So that's why I think the banking system is very important, and because it'll take it into more growth and more inflation. But as we've already discussed, that doesn't end well over 2 or 3 years, but it can still give us another couple of decent years of returns.
Well, and a couple of things that raises for me is questions. We are seeing better numbers out in terms of jobs growth. The inconsistency there is, and perhaps where I would disagree, is that the tax numbers have yet to improve at all. Payrolls are still in decline. Retail sales, in terms of the tax side of the equation, are still in decline. Income tax is still in decline, both federal and state. And we expect to see some of these things start recovering, if not already. Secondly, on the point of credit growth, I mean, we've seen a tremendous amount of credit created by the Fed and the Treasury, and then basically an asset swap. So the commercial banks have swapped bad paper, which now sits on the Fed balance sheet, for Treasuries, which now sit on the commercial bank balance sheet, which arguably is very healthy for the commercial bank system. Where I don't see the connection is to where there's actually an increase in lending to the private sector, and thus a pickup in the economy as a result of, you know, money turning over throughout the economy and a pickup in the velocity of money.
Sure. Well, what I've done is, because I tend to use a lot of financial history, I've looked back in history to see if we have anything comparable. And comparable is the right word. There's never anything that's the same, but is there anything comparable which is useful? And we have had a situation not that dissimilar from 1990 to 1994. We had a period when the banking system really wasn't producing very much credit, but not really contracting credit, where the jobs was a sluggish jobs recovery, the economy wasn't growing particularly strongly, consumption in particular wasn't good. We actually had, in nominal terms, declining consumer debt for I think it was 4, perhaps 5 consecutive quarters through that period. But through that period, we had a reasonable response in growth, and more importantly, we had a bull market in equities beginning as well. The reason is that at these turning points in the economy, we all wanted to be jobs and we all wanted to be consumption. It's a patriotic thing to feel that that's what our recovery should be. But the first several quarters can actually be driven by something entirely different, and that's what we've already seen. Inventory rebuilding is obviously one of them. But you get a lot of activity around the repackaging and the repurchase of assets and a lot of financial activity, which creates some growth as well. So it's not that uncommon that you would expect the consumer bit of the recovery to come a bit later. You're absolutely right in terms of the credit. There's no sign of it yet. I mean, this is a forecast. My forecast is that the American banking system has been well repaired and stands ready, willing, and able to start lending. I suppose the crucial point is there any demand for credit? Has the population of America been so turned off credit that even if the banks are ready to lend, they don't want to borrow? Well, it's certainly not the feedback we get from sort of small and medium enterprise, where and we hear a lot of stories about that, about those that sector of the economy not being able to access credit. But in terms of the consumer and why it's different from Japan is really because of inflation. Consumer inflation expectations, reasonably high levels. The TIPS, which is our financial indicator of future inflation, remain at relatively high levels. And the difference in Japan is that those tipped into fairly strong deflationary tendencies. and expectations. And there's very little incentive for anybody to borrow money when you get into a period of deflation and falling prices. And as long as people have an expectation of higher consumer prices, then the proclivity to borrow remains. So the jury is out quite clearly. There's no clear cut one way or the other. These banks are working yet, but I believe as this year progresses, we will see that. And as I mentioned, you know, you don't want to make forecasts. Just keep an eye on that weekly data from the Fed on the website, the H8. And if you see those credit numbers starting to pick up, then clearly something is moving in the right direction. And that would be the cautious way to do it. Wait until you see it rather than have to forecast it.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
Yeah, the other element to what you're suggesting in terms of demand for credit increasing is the motive of the commercial banking system on the other side to lend at all when they can leverage up an asset which is, in their opinion, risk-free, namely treasuries, and be looking at a 12 to 15% rate of return with virtually no risk. Why would they, until you see interest rates at the short end begin to rise, why would they end this perfect banking game, which is essentially no different than what we've had with Japan for years and years and years? It's an internal carry trade.
Yeah, it's important to stress that you could actually see a scenario, and I would argue that 91 to 94 was a scenario where the banks effectively plied into the treasury market, didn't provide a lot of private sector credit. But what they did do in plowing into the treasury market and expanding their balance sheets in the process was create money supply growth. So we have to divide these two things up very clearly, particularly for America. Based on that historical example, you might have banks which spend most of their time lending to the state, but in doing so, they're at least creating money supply growth. And as you know, on that basic Bernanke Great Depression argument, the secret is to keep money supply growth going. You would then say, well, what good is that? We're squeezing out the private sector and, you know, the banks are lending into the government sector. Yes, you create money, but if the private sector can't get credit, it's squeezed out and this is not good. But of course, this is America's huge advantage in that the banking sector doesn't provide all of the credit. You have the most disintermediated financial system in the world. If we look back over the past year and a half, in terms of where there's been credit growth, who's been providing that credit? Well, it's not been provided by the banks. It's been provided outside the banks. So people with existing monetary balances, and that was your household sector, were very big buyers of treasuries last year and very big buyers of corporate bonds. So savings were flowing from individuals, perhaps away from the equity market, to provide credit. So this is the strength of America. I would say even if your banking system concentrates heavily on lending to the government, and I think there's some evidence, I think, that they're getting involved in mergers and acquisitions. So there's some early evidence, perhaps, that they're moving beyond the government. This intermediated system, which can keep lots of credit flowing to the private sector. And as I said, the 91-94 example is where we actually saw that happening. Total credit growth was strong during that period, strong to the private sector, but the banks weren't really lending to the private sector. They were primarily lending to the government. So disintermediation may have been a weak spot going into this, but we all know the problem when you originate loans and don't really pay close attention to the credit quality and flip them into the disintermediated system. But coming out of this, it's a key strength for America to have a disintermediated system and a great contrast to Europe.
There's two things that I think of when I think of the treasury market over the next couple of years and almost sort of a conscription or forced purchase of treasuries. On the one hand, we have an audience overseas that's very interested in keeping their exchange rates low for competitive purposes in the manufacturing world. But the other issue, and they may continue to buy because they have to depress the value of their currencies, not because they necessarily want to, except for political reasons, as you've pointed out. The other is perhaps, you know, looking back at U.S. history, where there actually has been a conscription of bank assets and private assets for the purpose of U.S. Treasury purchases, you know, and I'm thinking about, you know, the period around World War II. Maybe you want to talk about how we could actually see rates pressured lower on the basis of sort of a forced purchase.
I think conscription is a very good word to use in this situation. We are going to be heading into a period where rising government bond yields are going to try and cramp government spending. Well, there's a great belief out there that the market will discipline the government. But actually, history doesn't suggest that all of the market will discipline the government. It's much more likely that the government will turn around and try to discipline the market. One way they can do it is this conscription issue. I would argue that that's already begun. We have new capital adequacy ratios for the banking system, which will compel them to hold more government bonds. It's one way it can be done. almost hate to use the word, but capital controls is another way that this can be done, preventing capital leaving the country. Another way this can be done is via a high transaction tax on non-government debt. So we would have a financial transaction tax on financial instruments, but that would exclude government debt, therefore making it more attractive. None of these things are particularly imminent, but I just want to point out, in terms of the word conscription, it's a way that the government can mobilize and can force credit towards the government debt market at a time when it will be desperate to do so. And given its strong influence over key banks in America, it can obviously play a role there as well in suggesting that they buy government debt. And it's important to stress this is not an American phenomenon. This is a developed world phenomenon, a Western world phenomenon, and we're likely to see this happening. I know Larry Summers said the new normal is low growth, but the new normal is that the government is permanently back involved in capital allocation in one way or another. So any listener who's thinking that the markets are determined by supply and demand has to wake up, smell the coffee, and realize that now it's supply, demand, and government. And if you ignore the government part of the equation, you can get things very wrong. And anybody who was short equities in March last year ignored the government part of the equation and paid a very high price for it. So words like conscription, which seem severe or extreme to some people, are words we're going to have to get used to hearing, because now the government's back in play, and that's exactly the sort of thing they've done historically.
Well, and if the government is back in play, then we can expect to see quite a fight in terms of stability in the interest rate market and stability in the pricing of treasuries. What you're arguing is that eventually this is how a bubble comes to the point where it simply cannot be controlled, and it does, in fact, burst. So what kind of price decline do you think we could see in U.S. treasuries on the other side of a government effort to hold this game together?
Okay, the best way to talk is in real terms, because it's real terms that count for bond markets and, in fact, all investment. But bond markets are particularly important given the fixed coupon, which makes you particularly vulnerable to inflation. So I think the best guide we have to this is Cillian Homer's book on the history of interest rates, which looks at the bear markets in treasuries we've had over the last 200 years. So the first thing to stress is they're very, very long. We don't usually get a bear market in treasuries which is over a year, 2 years, 3 years, four, five, or even 10. They tend to be 20 to 25-year events. So all I can point your listeners to is the previous one. And I think, according to Homer and Cilla, the real loss on holding treasuries from 1946 to 1979 was about 84%. And over that sort of time frame, I'm quite happy to believe that in real terms, that's the sort of loss you could have by holding on to treasuries. But this, we have to draw a line and say this doesn't mean that bond yields go shooting up in the near term, because the governments won't let them. Because if the markets will discipline the government, or the governments will try and discipline the market. So I fully expect to see action by the government to try and discipline the market. I will organize at the meeting taking place in Washington, D.C. today between the Greek Prime Minister and President Obama is an attempt to control the markets. The Greeks don't like the CDS business. They think it's being manipulated. They think it's pushing up the price of raising government debt. I have no opinion on that whatsoever. But it's a classic sign of a government being disciplined by a market and then saying the secret to this is not to abide by the market. The secret to this is to close the market. And as the ratchet comes on through higher interest rates going forward, all governments will be in this situation. And history tells you that governments will win and markets will lose. In the very long run, 20 or 30 years, markets may win. But for decades, governments can beat markets.
Well, and it seems that the sort of scapegoating, specifically that the meeting that you're suggesting between the Greek minister and President Obama, they're looking for a scapegoat, and the CDS market, the credit default swap market, is front and center for that. It's a lot easier to blame speculators for betting on the demise than it is to say there's a good reason for people to be liquidators of Greek debt, which has just the same impact as betting on the short side of the market. Long liquidation is just as powerful in pushing rates up and prices down. But that's not as in tune, as you say, with a political agenda, which is to find someone who's to blame, other than the Greek authorities who've spent themselves into poverty.
This is the most important thing. The most important thing is not to look at it from a market perspective, but to look at it from a society's perspective. If you look at it from a market perspective, you say this is the correct thing for the market to do. The market's correctly pricing it. And now society and politicians should respond to the market. The politicians will close the market. rather than respond. This is the simple lesson of history. In Ken and Rogoff and Carmen Reinhardt's new book, This Time is Different, which is an excellent read, which everybody should read, they point out that this leads, a banking crisis leads to a fiscal crisis, which leads to what they call financial suppression. And frankly, financial suppression is simply the government's trying to rig the markets to make sure they get what they want. So this little meeting at D.C. today is really the shape of things to come. It's the way it's going to go forward. And it is irrelevant that we think the market is right and the government is wrong, because the government will always be right, because the government changes the rules. So, you know, this is a fairly pessimistic outlook for the business and the business of capital allocation. But society will not be dictated by the markets as to who lives and who dies in terms of social spending. So we shouldn't sit in the markets and believe that they will, because it's not the way it's going to be. A simple choice has to be made by certain things, and society clearly will prefer to keep spending and ignore or close the markets.
Well, you see inflation picking up over the next few years, and just to summarize, you see stocks doing well until inflation hits about the 4% level, and that at that point you think inflation becomes actually a punishing element within the stock market. And perhaps whatever the stretch is, whether it's 6 months or 12 months or even longer, this bit of a rally that we've seen since the March lows continuing, perhaps, but ultimately the end game being the same, with equity values being incredibly, incredibly reasonable, with the Dow trading at, say, 4,000, 5,000. Is that more or less the case, where you see an initial push higher here and significantly lower just around the corner? What's your advice for the long-term investor?
Okay, well, that's exactly what I do see happening. I think as this economic recovery continues, it will be seen to be more and more normal. It'll have credit growth, it'll have jobs growth. And the more normal it is, people will think that's that cycle over, we're back now into another cycle. The thing that changes this cycle forever will be what happens in the emerging market. You have to look at inflation globally. We have to look at inflation in America. And if it gets near 4%, my recommendation on equities is to be very careful. Historically, in the post-World War II era, when inflation has been rising from low levels and reaching near 4%, that really has been a danger sign for equities. But why I mention, even in the context of U.S. equities, why I mention emerging market inflation is it's when they get reasonably high levels of inflation that they have to respond with higher exchange rates. And that's really what creates the chaos for the American Treasury market and the whole Western world's debt market. So every morning I wake up, I try to think of what I would want to own for the long run, what I would just buy today and not have to play this next cycle, not have to worry about the crash. And there really are very few things I would buy. But a basket of Asian currencies seems to be a reasonable way of preserving wealth over the long haul. But the next crisis, when it comes, we'll see Asian currencies going up relative to the dollar, relative to the euro, relative to sterling. And we'll see asset prices across the developed world and the emerging world coming down. So in terms of what, you may not make a lot of money on the Asian currencies, but in terms of what it can buy in terms of assets in your own jurisdiction after the crash, it will be able to buy a hell of a lot. So I try to think of others. There are other things you can be short, of course, to make money, but you've got to get your timing right for those. So if someone just wants to put some money away now, sit on it for 5 to 10 years and have the opportunity to get into U.S. equities at cheap levels, I think they should buy a basket of Asian currencies. The one caveat, of course, would be that if we do end up with capital controls within this period, you will have free capital outside of the United States of America, and you may be loath to bring it back, because when you bring it back, it'll be difficult to get that back out again. I think you bring it back anyway. I think, you know, when the time comes, when the market's at 400, everybody will be telling you not to buy it, that it is a disaster and it can only go lower. And I think one of the main arguments will be, well, if you buy it, you'll never get your money out of the United States again. And I think you buy it anyway, because that over a long time will change. And anyway, you're living in America and you need to spend money in America and you're retiring in America, so there's no reason to bring the money back. But there will be very good reasons why people will tell you that it's a disastrous investment at 400. And I think that's the sort of thing people will be talking about, the bankruptcy of the government, capital controls. These are exactly the sort of huge structural negatives which usually push markets to very low levels. So it'll take a lot of courage to buy at 400. I mean, it took a lot of courage to buy last March. So we'll have to wait and see. So, but those are the type of events, I think, extreme events that can give us the sort of low valuations we saw in 1921, 1932, 1949, and 1982.
Well, thank you, Russell, for joining us, and we look forward to carrying on the conversation again in the future.
Thank you.
Well, David, I've always enjoyed Russell Napier being on the program. You know, we've had him on several times back in 2008, 2009. We've had him on now, and we're seeing the plan that he saw formulating after studying the other bear markets of the past century. We're seeing this thing unfolding very similar to what he had explained back in 2006 when he wrote the book.
I think there's, again, a reminder that we need to put out there for any of our listeners that if you haven't read The Anatomy of the Bear, it's going to be one of the tougher things that you work through, but absolutely valuable in terms of the history and the perspective that it brings to the way that you view the stock markets and other asset classes. The Anatomy of the Bear, I think, was originally published in 2004.
Yeah, that's right. So it was actually earlier than what I had expected, which is amazing because it reads, this is a man who actually talked about the bear market going until 2014, back in 2004.
I think there's several things that I agree with him very strongly, Kevin, that we do see a similar end game, sovereign debts being front and center this year and over the next couple of years. Mohammed Alarian at PIMCO has come to a similar conclusion that sovereign debts are the issue of 2010. And, of course, their allocations have been to reduce exposure to the U.S. dollar and increase exposure to Canadian currencies and other foreign currencies. I think the one thing that I would probably disagree with Russell in this particular interview is perhaps the implicit strength within the commercial banking system. I don't see that going beyond being very self-serving.
Right.
We have an amazing repair work which is occurring on the balance sheet of these commercial entities, and I think that continues. But as he said, there's no sign of that lending coming out into the private sector from the public sector, and that would have to be a significant shift. We would have to see the velocity of money pick up, which as of yet we haven't seen.
Well, you make a great point, because actually these commercial banks are making guaranteed money and able to leverage on this guarantee by buying treasury bills. Why in the world would they give Johnny down the street a business loan when there's a risk to it?
Right. And the other thing, Kevin, I think is that when you're looking at currencies, and I would probably side with the David Einhorns and John Paulsons, when I look at currencies, what I'm trying to do is escape the web that is so entangling, and which Russell Napier points out, that we are moving away from sort of a market-driven economy and towards more of a command economy where, yes, politicians and their role coming in to support a given asset class are frankly more important. The problem with making a bet on currencies is you're making a bet on a given administration. If that's simply 9 Politburo members in China, that's who you're betting on when you're buying the renminbi. If it is the current administration in Canada, you're making it a bet on the administration, and that is more than just a currency bet. Not knowing what direction policy will take them, and knowing that everything is becoming more and more politicized in the markets, I'm not confident in betting with bureaucrats, frankly.
Well, you know, David, you're talking about betting on a currency that is fiat. We've made the point in the past that the world is on a grand new experiment where there really is no currency that's backed by anything other than paper promises.
Now, this is where I think we find a perfect complement to what Russell Napier is saying, because what he's really talking about from a long-term investor's standpoint is being willing to reallocate capital at the right time. This is one of the reasons we created our wealth management platform 2 years ago and have had some success in the interim, but we created it because we do see a transition point where for those who have preserved value, specifically in precious metals, will have the opportunity to look at U.S. equities with the S&P trading at 400 or 500, with the Dow trading between 4 and 5,000, and that endgame being brought about by a sovereign debt crisis. So we have looked at and see a tremendous amount of similarity in terms of the big picture analysis. I think the interim is where we might depart in slight nuances with Russell, but on par, on a whole, I think we've got a lot of similarities over the next 2, 3, 4 years.
Well, he's actually saying keep your powder dry because there are going to be buying opportunities, but it's not right now unless you're a risk taker.
And those buying opportunities, again, you'd have to go back over the last 100 years, and it's on par with 1921, on par with 1932, on par with 1949, and on par with 1982 in terms of ridiculously cheap equities and bonds. And we see that as an excellent time to redeploy into more productive assets. Between here and there, we think the risks are innumerable. We think the risks are almost incalculable. And the complicating factor, as he so adequately points out, is that these are no longer just market dynamics, but it's politics front and center. And actually, Kevin, that's one of the themes that we're exploring in this year's DVD, the DVD that we'll release in June, is the complication that Washington brings to any bet on Wall Street.
You know, that's interesting that he brought that up as well. He said it's no longer supply and demand. You have to factor in the government. So it's supply, demand, government. Boy, doesn't that sound a lot like what we've talked about? It goes from the financial to the economic to the political to the geopolitical, okay, or the social. It's a situation where we have to factor in things right now that we can't predict just based on supply and demand.
Yeah, and it's certainly not the case that history shows within every instance you move from the financial to the economic, economic to the political, political to the geopolitical. But the relationships between those four categories are very, very important to understand, and we do have that progression today. The negative feedback loops and the potential for those political decisions impacting the market and impacting finances is absolutely paramount, and ultimately we do see a scenario where scapegoating on an international basis is going to occur. As we've begun to see in Eastern and Southern Europe, we will see even here in the United States between the U.S. and China.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Russell Napier. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.